were you affected by downturn in the oil industry?
I think everybody certainly has been impacted by, you know, the downturn in the industry. For us, though, because we're so focused on mineral royalty acquisitions,
yeah,
it takes a while for that to sort of filter down to mineral owners. I think for a couple of reasons. One, their checks often are delayed by, you know, up to 6 months. So the check they're receiving now could be from production 6 months ago. So that short-term price movement, you know, they don't see right away. Also, they're just farther away typically from the industry. They're not in the industry. They're just collecting the checks that they get from the royalties that they have on the land. And so, you know, certainly some impact. We've seen some prices adjusted because of it, especially in places like Oklahoma. But I think it just takes a little bit longer on the mineral side to sort of filter through than it does on the E&P side.
Okay, but it, they won't be in a situation where they won't get anything at all, or they will.
Right.
It will hit them eventually.
I mean, you know, they'll, yeah, it'll hit them eventually, and they'll just see their checks go down, right? I mean, they're going to get less in terms of oil and gas production, either through price or through activity, and I think recent downturn, it's going to be both, right?
Uh-huh.
It's going to be from reduced activity, less wells being drilled, and from lower price. So, it'll filter through eventually. It's just they're a little bit delayed. So.
And so how long you've been in the industry doing this?
Let's see. So I personally have been in the oil and gas industry since 2004. Actually, no, before that, 2002. I did mineral and royalties for a short time from 2006 to 2008. Then I went and worked for Shell. And then I did that for 9 years and then had an opportunity to come here and get back into the minerals business. And I've been doing minerals now since 2016, May of 2016.
Good.
Yeah.
Do you think like this oil, the state of industry it is right now, you think it's a new reality long term? That should be, right?
You know, it's hard to say. Our industry has had tons of cycles, you know, ups and downs.
Yeah,
right?
80s, 90s.
The 80s, the 90s, 2008. You know, we saw some of this is actually from, you know, what we saw back in 2015, 2016.
15 was pretty bad. 16,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly. So, you know, it certainly feels different, but there's been so many ups and downs, I don't know that any of them ever felt the same, right? So, you know, I think the industry will come back. Will we see $100 oil again? I don't know. It doesn't seem like it.
Yeah.
Seems like technologies have advanced to the point where we now have just got so much better at finding oil and gas and producing it more efficiently that I doubt, you know, we kind of get back into those really high numbers that we saw before.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I think it'll come back.
All right. So I guess, what's your like educational background? What did you do before?
So I went to school for fine art.
Fine arts.
Yeah, which you don't find too many folks in the oil and gas industry with a fine art background. And then actually, when I got out of school, I did graphic design for a couple of years, and then I went to business school. And I got a finance degree, and while I was at business school, I worked at a small E&P company part-time, and that's how I got into the business. And then when I graduated business school, I just stayed in oil and gas, and I've been in oil and gas ever since. I went to business school in 2002, and that's kind of been my start, so I've been there ever since.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that company, are you guys in Colorado?
Yeah, so we're based in Colorado, but all of our assets are in Oklahoma and Texas.
That's good. And so when you come to a conference like that,
yes,
what you trying to achieve or get out of it, just make contacts?
Yeah, you know, I think this year's different for us. This is our very first year having a booth.
Oh, really?
So we've been coming to the conference for years. In fact, my CEO has been coming since the very first conference. This is our first year having the booth, so this is kind of a new experience for us. Certainly trying to expand our network and our contacts. I think also brand awareness.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, This is, as they say, where deals happen. Certainly for those folks that have a mineral deal, we'd love to look at it and see if it makes sense for something for us to buy. So.
Yeah, I noticed there are so many like operating companies, small, like a lot of small companies.
Yeah.
So you basically, and if they have some prospects to offer, you would just go there and look at the prospects, right? And how does it, like, if you're interested, what's your next move?
Yeah, so, you know, it depends, really, on kind of what they're interested in doing. So for us, looking at it from a minerals perspective, if they have a mineral portfolio to try to sell, or you're an operator and you're going to carve off an overriding royalty, an ORRI, and you want to sell that, those are things we look at. I think this really here, NAEP is the start of that conversation, right? It's like, okay, that looks good. This looks interesting. Let's talk some more. And I think then from there, it becomes more of a data exchange, and you see if you put a deal together. I mean, I think this is the start of the conversation, but it's not the end, right? This is just to kind of get things going.
All right. Are you involved in financing any projects?
Yeah.
Financing projects, and
like the financial part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, we have a large equity sponsor, and that's a Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, CPPIB.
Mm.
But we don't, like, finance, like, somebody's drilling program or finance projects directly. Now, that being said, if an operator is looking to carve off an overriding royalty and they're going to use those funds for drilling, and that's what they need the money for, and I guess in sort of an indirect way, we're helping them to finance that project. But that's how that would come about. But we wouldn't just go to a project and say, okay, yeah, let's put money into that. But we would do a buy and an overriding royalty, and through that would be a way that they would be getting the funds from us.
Yeah. So again, to the type of business, so you said like you acquire mineral rights, right,
yes,
for example, from owners.
From owners, correct.
So that means that those owners no longer have access to their rights. They sold it to you.
Right. Typically what they'll do, though, is if they own the surface and the minerals, they're just selling us the minerals, just the stuff below the surface. So they still have their home, access to the surface, whatever they're using the surface for, whether it's farming or agriculture or whatever. It's just now we own the rights down below. So we would be the ones that now negotiate for leasing with the operator if there's not a lease in place. Otherwise, we just step into whatever contract has already been put in place. So if that mineral owner already has those minerals leased, we just step into their shoes. There's nothing really to go negotiate with the operator. The terms are already set.
Good, good.
Yeah.
And so even in that situation when those people have surface rights, let's say they have a house or a bit of land, and let's say if the oil company, drilling company, wants to come put a rig on it, do operations, do they still get something out of surface or no?
Yeah, they probably would get. Yeah, I mean, the operator is going to have to negotiate a surface use agreement with them.
Mm.
So they'll get something for, you know, the oil company coming and disturbing the land. And, you know, if they have to build a road or build a well pad or whatever it might be, you know, the surface owner will be compensated some way for that. But they're not going to get anything out of the production that's produced, right? So at that point, you know, it doesn't, the surface owner isn't going to be impacted on whether it's a good well or a bad well, right? They're just going to get paid for the surface disturbance.
How does, like, it seems like, so I traveled a lot of in this country, almost feels like so much of there's a private land, right?
Yeah.
And so those people who have those rights, how did they acquire it in the first place? Was it inherited mostly, like they bought it?
Mostly inherited. You're going to see some folks that you know, were in the oil industry or wanted some exposure to the oil industry that went out and bought it. Retired geologists, I think, in a lot of instances have gone out and bought in prospects areas they knew about when they worked at their gas, you know, oil and gas company. But I think inheritance has really been one of the primary transfers of that mineral rights through time. It's only been recently, in recent times, where you've seen sort of real explosion of mineral companies like ourselves that are going out there and buying these in sort of a real industry-type fashion, you know, and acquiring all this. I mean, that's really something that's transpired in the last 5 to 10 years.
How much, like, those can be worth as an example, estimates?
Yeah, a lot. It depends. I mean, there are ranch families in Texas that, billionaires from
rights.
Now they own vast amounts of land with lots of oil, but the numbers can get really big.
But even big. So it's on the magnitude of like several tens of millions.
Could be. I mean, there's some folks that own something really small, right? And maybe it's only worth a couple thousand dollars. It just depends on where it's located, scale, and size. But certainly the numbers can get pretty big.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so basically there are two types of that. Like, you can either buy those rights outright from the start, or you can negotiate a deal with them where you don't buy it, but like sort of you're like a middleman. You like pay them something, but you negotiate with the operators. Does it work like that?
No, not too much. I mean, certainly there are guys that buy these rights to try to turn around and sell them to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of being a middleman between the owner and the operator, no, it doesn't quite work that way.
So it's like if you go acquire property that's like all yours, and then you said you work with operators.
Yeah.
But it's not like you sort of, like, I don't know, like renting, where like those people still have the rights, but they don't deal with operators. I mean, they could hire you to do those deals.
So typically, the way it works is that the person who owns the rights is the one that negotiates with the operator and figures the lease.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that on a one-on-one basis. I mean, you can go hire a lawyer if you want, if you feel like you need to. There are instances where you could carve out what's called a non-participating royalty interest, NPRI.
Mm-hmm.
In that instance, then what happens is you take basically part of the royalty and you sell it.
Mm-hmm.
You retain part of it. The part you retain, you say, that has all the executive rights, that has all of the decision-making.
Uh-huh.
And you're just really selling the cash flow to somebody else. That's called an NPRI, non-participating royalty interest.
Okay. But yeah, even so, what do folks do? Like, they just happen to have the land and mineral rights, but they're like far away from oil industry. They don't understand anything, no value. And if they want to get something out of it, would they like hire you, for example, or?
Yeah, they could do it a couple of ways. I mean, you can just do some Google searches to find out who's buying. So they wouldn't hire us, but they could certainly come to us and we would make them an offer
to buy.
If they want to have somebody try to go out and market that, you know, their best approach is probably to go find a landman from a land brokerage company, and that landman can help them either negotiate the lease or sell it or whatever they want to end up doing. That's typically what they do. They go find like a land broker and say, okay, help me here. I don't know what I'm doing. Help me figure this out.
That's good. Yeah. And like, let's say for you, like, let's say if you acquire that land mineral rights, and you can just hold on to it, right? And then let's say if in the future it increases in value, then you can sell it for more, right, for profit.
Yeah.
That's what you can do, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, as more wells get drilled on it, more activity happens, the value of that's going to increase.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, so most of people that work at your company, are they landmen?
So at our company, we have a sister company that's a traditional E&P company.
Right.
So everybody that works on the E&P company works on the mineral company. So we have engineers, geologists, landmen, accountants, basically everything you need to run an E&P company.
Yeah.
They're also working on our mineral company.
Yeah. What it's called?
Four Point.
And where are you all located?
We're in Denver, Colorado.
Denver.
Yeah.
Type of people that you hire, like you said, it's not landmen, right? Or mostly landmen.
Yeah, it's everybody. Everybody you'd need in an E&P company.
No, but like for yours in particular, for Long Point.
Yeah, it's all still.
It's all still E&P. Okay.
Yeah. Like I said, we have geologists, petroleum engineers, accountants.
Yeah.
Landmen. We have it all.
Where do you find these new people, fresh people?
So you know, I think a lot of our recruiting happens online. You know, we put out our resumes and stuff online. We put job descriptions out and then get feedback. But we have a pretty rigorous hiring process, so we really focus in on people, have an extremely high retention rate. I mean, I think since I've been with the company, what's that been, 4 years now, I think only three people have left. We have 100 people in the office and about 250 people in the field, so that's a pretty big retention rate, right?
Yeah.
So it's really important to us. When everybody's hired into our company, they go through several interview processes, but the final one is what we refer to as the gauntlet.
It's what?
The gauntlet.
Gauntlet.
And you have to sit down, and the entire management team asks you questions. So it's a bit intense, but we really want to make sure that the people we bring in are going to fit well with the team, fit with our culture, be the right high quality people that we need, because we want them to stay. And, and so we just put a lot into it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't work with students, recent grads?
Yeah, we have an internship program that we have over the summer. We bring in a number of interns over the summer, and some of those have developed into full-time positions. We don't have necessarily a recent graduate program like you'd find at a large company like at a Shell or an Exxon or something, but we definitely hire new graduates. I mean,
that's good. And do you work with any of the societies, like Landmen Society, Society of Petroleum Engineers?
Yeah, I mean, we're members of a lot of those, and we do work with them. I don't know. I wish our HR person here was, because I can ask exactly what kind of interaction we have there for recruiting.
Yeah.
I know there's some, I just don't know what the details of it are, but I know that it does exist.
Yeah. And let's say if some students want to work at your company, what skills they need to have? What to develop?
Well, you know, I mean, so besides just having the base technical understanding they need to fill whatever job it is that we're filling, I think, we're really looking for team players.
Yeah.
Folks, you know, I know that word gets tossed around a lot, oh, I want a team player, but I think when we think about a team player, we think about somebody that's really kind of doing whatever to make sure that the entire team succeeds. That means, you know, nobody's looking around going, oh, that's not my job, I don't want to do it. It's like, oh, that needs to get done, I'm going to jump on and get that. Even if that's not something I'm directly responsible for, I'm going to jump on and make sure that gets done. And that's really kind of the philosophy that permeates throughout the organization.
Okay.
I think that's one of the really key skills. So going along with that, though, is, you know, communication and interpersonal skills, being a good people person, being able to relate to people, being somebody that folks want to relate with. It just makes all of that more easy, right? I mean, you can't have somebody just going off and doing something if they're not a good communicator, because then instead of being helpful, that kind of gets perceived as like, well, what's that person doing, right? But if everyone's communicating, they're talking well, then people can kind of jump on and get things done that need to get done, and everybody just sort of knows, okay, I know that's getting done, this is getting handled over here. So I think those are a couple of top qualities for sure.
What then communication channels most people use or in your company?
So we use a lot of verbal communication. I think, you know, we have a pretty open office floor plan. We have what we call our energy bar, which is a central part in the office that's got, you know, snacks and all that kind of stuff for people to come hang out at. So like that energy bar becomes like a place where everybody kind of like comes together, exchange a lot of ideas and all that kind of stuff. Electronic communication and stuff is there. But we don't have I know some offices have like a, almost like an instant messenger that'll pop up on your screen. If you want to shit. We don't have anything like that. I think most folks in our office just walk down and say, you know, hey, I want to talk to you about this. So a lot of verbal communication in our office.
That's good.